Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm your host, Michael Pasquale, a partner and financial advisor here at UBS Financial Services with the Soteria Wealth Management team. I'm here in New York City, as always, and as always, I can be reached at michael.pasquale, P-A-S-Q-U-A-L-E, at ubs.com. Today, we are honored to be joined by Adam Parker, founder and chief executive officer of Trivariate Research, an independent equity research firm known for its data-driven insights and differentiated perspective on markets. Adam is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, and the views today he will share are purely his own. In this episode, we will explore Adam's journey through the world of investing, from his early start in finance and rapid rise as a leading semiconductor analyst, to his experience across both the buy side and the sell side, and then ultimately building his own firm. We'll dive into how he thinks about data versus instinct, what it takes to stand out in research, and how he approaches decision-making in an increasingly complex market environment. Finally, we'll step beyond the numbers to discuss what wealth and well-being mean to Adam from his perspective. So Adam, thank you very much for joining me today on Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm thrilled to be able to spend some time with you today and really appreciate you being here with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Let's get started right away. How about a little bit of background on you from the beginning? You know, you and I have crossed paths a few times over the years, and you've done a lot of really great and interesting things across the world of finance. Maybe start a little bit about what pulled you into finance and maybe data in particular, which is really something that you're very well known for in the first place, and then how that sort of led into to what's been an amazing career.
Well, thanks for that. I did a PhD in statistics. I mean, you're asking kind of a personal question, so I'll give you a personal answer. I mean, my dad has a PhD from MIT. He kind of told me, if you do the PhD, it'll probably, the bear case will be, you'll be the most popular statistics professor in college or something. Like, you'll guarantee like a decent quality of life. It'll separate you from your peers and that kind of stuff. And so I just did what my parents told me to do. I did the PhD, and I had a close friend, was best man at my wedding, was an analyst at a firm called Sanford Bernstein. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I'll interview there. And it just turned out to be an amazing place. I didn't know what a stock or bond was till I was pretty much 30 years old. So I know a lot of people think, I interview these young kids now and I'm impressed with the amount they know when they're in college. That wasn't really something that came to me until later in life.
Back then too, remember the old Bernstein initial interviews? I mean, how challenging those were. And
it
wasn't necessarily about stocks and bonds. It's really about how you think. And I remember that back in the day.
I didn't know this until later, but I was told later, I had a great run at Bernstein. In fact, I ran into last night Lou Sanders, who ran the firm for years. Yep. Just randomly, I ran into him coincidentally. What I was told later was that I had the optimal amount of paranoia. I always love that. Like, they're screening for somebody who's not on the fringe, but is driven by and motivated by the paranoia. And I think that optimal paranoia is something that you still try to find in people where they're hungry and they're after, but they're not crazy about it. They're not insane. Yeah. That was what was incredible about the Bernstein culture. And that was really my first foray into anything financial at all.
What a great firm. What a great place to start.
Yeah, it was awesome. I remember I went to University of Michigan. Exactly. The leaders and the best.
Senior there.
Yeah. When I was taking a statistics class my first year there, I remember reading this thing. I haven't told the story. I've done a million podcasts. I've never told a story, but it made me think of it. There was a question, and it was sort of like one of these dumb questions of like, you know, Mike goes to a restaurant and he asks what kind of pie there is. And the waitress says, oh, there's apple and blueberry. And he says, oh, I'll take the blueberry. And then when the waitress is bringing the blueberry, she says, there's also cherry. And he says, okay, I'll take apple instead. And that's all they tell you. And so the question is like, did he change his mind? Is he fickle? What's going on? And it turned out, paragraph later, well, this guy knew there was two pastry chefs. One makes apple and blueberry only, and he likes the blueberry better than the apple. And the other one makes cherry also, and he likes the apple better than the blueberry. And I read that, and I thought, well, that's awesome. Like, there's always something you don't know and that somebody else does. And so I just always kind of was into that, like, second layer unknown thing. And it just turned out, I didn't know this, that the stock market is just the ultimate one of those sort of like what kind of pie is being served and who's making it kind of things. And so that was literally the thing that got me into wanting to study statistics and then ultimately kind of do research. Weird story, but yeah.
That's great.
That's the truth.
I can tell already, Adam, I'm not going to stick to my questions. My mind is already going in other different directions. And I want to get back to that optimal amount of paranoia quote. I absolutely love that. And the first thing that I think about when you said that is, what is the optimal amount of optimism? Because I feel like, especially look at the tape today, right? Look at what's happened the last few weeks. Now Iran is behind us. Everybody's trying to get involved in SpaceX. I have clients that are calling now about, you know, buying on top of the 20% lift we saw Friday. And I feel like we're too far up that optimistic scale. You know, there's still a lot of craziness that's going on in the world, but the optimism around the market is probably the most bullish I've seen in my career. And I'm interested in your thought there around the optimal amount of optimism to go with your optimal amount of paranoia.
You know, it's a good question. I mean, and there's actually a quantitative way to think about it in a way. I think a lot about a concept called distance from median. I think there's a lot of like behavioral science stuff. Like if a child's raised with no discipline, then maybe they turn into something in the streets or drugs. And if they're raised with too much discipline, that can also kind of stymie them from being. And so there's like a right amount of discipline to raise your child with, right? And then the farther you get from that median, the worse the distribution of outcomes are. I'll make a finance analogy. You want a company to have a median payout ratio, 30, 40% gets paid out for the dividend. If it gets too high, there's risk they cut it. If it's too low, they're not really serious about it and they could destroy value with a dumb deal or something. So the distance from median payout gets a penalty. There's a penalty for the farther you get from the median. Okay, I'm just throwing that concept out there. And I think there's a lot.
That could be from the downside, too negative and too positive.
Right. You want an optimal amount of discipline when you raise your kid. You want an optimal payout ratio. You want an optimal amount of paranoia. You want an optimal amount of optimism, right? And if you get way too optimistic, it's bad. And if you're not optimistic enough, that's bad, right? I think people get used to thinking like good is a little bit better. Top quintile, second, third, fourth, fifth. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes the middle is fine. And then think about valuation, right? Like I don't really think it works to pick stocks, but very, very cheap is obviously bad and very, very expensive is bad. And there's some middle ground 60th, 70th percentile valuation that seems to be fine. And the farther you get from that, there's a penalty. So it's not low is good and bad is great or bad is good and low is great. Sometimes it's just the middle is good. And the farther you get from the middle, it's penalized. And I think about that concept a lot. Obviously, we're talking about raising children and also payout ratios in the same conversation. But I think there's something to that. You want to have some optimism. Okay. Otherwise, you're the guy who owns 10-year yield your whole career and you missed everything good, but you don't want to be irrationally optimistic. And so I think there's an optimal amount. I think there's less insanity today than there was in 2000, to be honest with you, in some regards, because the fundamentals are different. And we can talk about that more if you want. But I think it's probably the second craziest in my career.
I think it's actually a good point. I mean, I was too junior back in 2000 to even realize just how crazy things were with where valuations were, and was coming out of business school at the time and, you know, happy to have a job and making good money. And then all of a sudden, you know, the world just came to an end. That's a good parallel, I think. It's certainly different than the GFC, which wasn't like this. In my mind, I didn't feel like we were in this raging overvaluation bullish scenario, whether that was real estate or whatever was happening underlying. Where I feel now, we do need, as advisors, we do need to continuously remind our clients to stick to the plan. And that's more and more of my conversations these days.
So two things on that, or maybe even one quick one. Micron, I used to be a semiconductor analyst, as you said. So in the peak of 2000, Micron earned $1.25 in one quarter. And analysts were saying things like, well, you annualize that, let's pay four times that, that's $5. I'll pay 20 times the $5, Micron's worth $100. And so they were paying like 20 times an annualized number that they only earned in one quarter. Today, the street's got 100, I think the buy side's got probably $140 in earnings from Micron. The thing trades at a much lower multiple without any annualizing on a full year number. So the valuations on things are nowhere near as crazy for big companies as they were in 2000. That I think is fair. Timing when the data center overbuild will be a problem, I think, is really hard. The second comment you made, there's tons of work I've done on it. I think you will definitely destroy value if you try to make 1 month market calls for your clients or in your career. And I'll tell you an amazing story. So when I was at Morgan Stanley, I was a US equity strategist. And you can imagine, same as UBS, there's a strategist and their team in every asset class in every region of the world. There's US equities, Europe, EFA, right? There's rates, there's currencies, there's economics. So we had an email group And the idea was you email, oh, client sent some invoice to March Media. I'll share it with my other colleagues around the world, that type of vibe. It turned into a little bit of a brag fest that I met so-and-so and so-and-so, but generally it was supposed to be about sharing knowledge. And so I decided this, because I did US equities, everyone had a view of my market, but I didn't have a view of the EM currency. I didn't give a, I didn't really care about the foreign versus the zloty or whatever. But that guy had a strong view of the US equity market. So I asked all these people, what do you think predicts the US equity market? And I got a long list. I think it's the KOSPI, it's the transports, it's the moving average conversion divergence, it's the changes in VIX, it's the whatever. I made a giant list of all these technicals and fundamental. And then I said, okay, let me build a model. Let's take the smartest people. All these people make millions of dollars in their teams all around the world. We'll take their top ideas and we'll test whether we can make a 1 month market call. It turned out about 17% of the months, the market goes down 2.5% or more. So it's about twice a year, right? 1 out of 6 times. So I thought, well, that'd be super useful if I could call somebody like you and say, hey, man, this is going to be a down 2.5% or more month. Let's chill out. Like, let's sell some equities. That would be useful. So I thought, let me take the best ideas and build an actual model to see if I could predict these down months. Using all the best ideas from all these over, you know, highly paid guys, the answer was I would destroy value. Because half the time that I thought the market would be bad, the market was good. And then the times that I didn't think was bad, it sometimes was. So you destroy a lot of your clients' value by trying to make 1 month market calls and pull money out of the market. So I could send you a note I wrote on that, but I would really, really tell people not to try to make 1 month market calls. Yeah.
My background still for almost 30 years was on the sales and trading side. And then the last 2.5 managing money for individuals and institutions. And that conversation, Adam, you know, from a couple months ago, when the first downdraft started with Iran and everything, and clients would call and be like, okay, let's go to cash. I said, well, we're not trading this account. We're investing the account. Going to cash throws off our entire FGA plan. Then we got to worry about coming back in and timing that. The folks that were aggressively asking to make sure we move to cash still have not come back in. They missed the entire rally back. If they'd have just kept the course, we'd be in such a better place.
Totally. This is probably the best call I've ever had, but it was nobody knows about it. But when I worked at Bernstein, I got sort of this responsibility on the 401k plan, the fiduciary responsibility for the employees. And this was in 2008. And there was a committee of us, and I stumbled on this by accident. So I'm gonna be like, oh, I said something smart by accident, which is what happened. I didn't have some grandiose intelligent plan. What happened is we allowed employees, when they started, they would choose their 401k allocations, equities, bonds, whatever. And at that time, there was a cash maximum of 10% you were allowed to choose. And because it was the financial crisis in 08, a couple of the people said, well, I want to be able to choose 100% cash. So I asked a question and I stumbled on something that was probably the best call I've ever had. I said, what percentage of employees ever change their allocation after they start working for the 401k plan? And the answer was less than 10%. And these are all people in the financial profession. This was a life mercy. So imagine how you would have screwed people if you allowed them to choose 100% cash in the financial crisis. So fortunately, they kept the 10% governor on. People chose the 10% because they were buried up in the financial crisis. But all these years later, all the employees who worked there had to choose equity or bonds and basically couldn't have screwed that up versus cash no matter what. None of these people know me. They haven't thanked me. I haven't gotten a latte. Okay. But like, I probably made a lot of their employees.
You do. I know.
Yeah. But that was like, that was all stumbling on it by like, did people change? Like, and most people just choose, oh, I'll take the growth fund, I'll take the value fund, I'll then, and they never change their allocation the whole career.
By the way, what a great point, Adam. Today, the last year or two, is the first time that we're starting to experience 401k balances that are in the $5, $6, $7, $8 million range, right? Because if you look at history with what started and the discipline around investing and companies being pushed to match and all of that, we're now starting to see that 65 plus generation that can look at their 401k plan and say, I'm very wealthy from that, unless they went
you got cash, you got 0.1% in your account. Right.
It's an amazingly astute point. I've never changed my allocation. I've been at UBS for 17 years, Deutsche Bank previous to that, Financial Securities previous to that. I don't think I've ever changed. I've been risk on and I've just sort of let it go. But you're right. I don't even check it that often. So it's funny that is such a big part of the investment community here in the United States that could have been steered completely wrong if an option was there to actually
I think if I could go back and start over, I would have had a much more serious view of that. I just thought, well, that won't be very much my net worth when I get older. So I didn't like focus on trading in and out of it very much. And like you said, it can be really chunky and grows over time. So yeah, anyway, staying fully allocated matters.
Let's rewind. You know, you mentioned the semiconductor analysts, and I already mentioned how you were leading analysts. You had that quick rise early on, especially as a top-ranked semiconductor analyst back then. I mean, that was the top of the heap. You know, what did you do? What did you see? How did you think differently back then for sort of our younger audience that led to that success or that helped, you know, create that environment of success for you, Adam?
It comes a little bit back to what we talked about earlier, which is Bernstein had a unique culture, right? They generally hired people from the industry or from McKinsey who consulted in the industry. And I was one of the very few counterexamples who kind of got promoted internally. And I do think the PhD helped me. I just sort of argued that, you know, I'm analytical, and I don't know if that argument would work today with all AI tools basically taking analytical skill to zero. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I was just really excited about being an analyst. I said, I think I can do this. They gave me an opportunity. And the first person who kind of switched the semiconductor job open. So it was just luck that I got an awesome sector. It could have been European electric utilities. It could have been anything. I would have been psyched to do any sector. I didn't care. Yeah. And the fact that it was semis was just luck. Back then, and this is aging myself, NVIDIA was too small by market cap for me to cover. It didn't crack the top 10 list. So yeah. The biggest company was
a video game company.
Yeah, it was kind of a B minus GPU company along with another one called ATI, which got bought by AMD. So I covered a bunch of companies. Most of them got acquired. Linear, Maxim, Xilinx, Altera, National Semi. They all got bought by Texas Instruments, Analog Devices, and other companies. And so it's kind of a crazy move. But it turned out to be a great sector because there's a combination of different business models, right? I feel like there's two things that young people should probably focus on more. One is have a really good understanding of what a company really, what their margin should be. Like, understand when you run your own business, I've been running my own business for several years now, you kind of know who has pricing power over you and who doesn't. You know which business model. So sometimes I can look at somebody's model and be like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, they're not going to achieve that margin, or I don't understand. I spent a lot of time thinking about what a business's margin should be if it's run well and where estimates are achievable, because I think margin achievability is a big part of getting stocks right. And then the second thing is accounting. And I know it's easy to say, well, I can learn it for free. And I agree with that. You don't need to go to college to know accounting. But the level of accounting details that great investors know is a lot. I spent a lot of time thinking about that because I think companies that beat estimates tend to outperform, and companies that miss tend to underperform. And so really thinking through what could cause estimate achievability. I launched as a semiconductor analyst October 1st, 2002. And the title was Share Gainers and Margin Expanders Are Multiple Expanders. That's aged pretty well. There's other things I've written that have aged like old milk or whatever. But, you know, I think that's generally still true. You're looking for businesses that are gaining share and the margins are expanding, and you're trying to avoid those where the opposite's true. Yeah.
Is that what it's become? Or did you have to sort of bob and weave and shift gears a little bit over the years here?
Yeah. No, it's another sort of personal question. I'm not sure what this applies to others, but I worked 11 and a half years at Bernstein. So did the PhD, was a semiconductor analyst, ran research there for 1 year. I didn't want to run research. It was one of those weird things where I didn't realize this as a younger person that they asked me if I would do it. And I said no, because I didn't want to do it. And then I didn't realize when you say no, they want you to do it more. You know what I mean? It was like forbidden fruit thing by accident or whatever. So they came back to me and said, you should do this, whatever. And so I did it for a year. But fortunately, the strategy job opened up and I thought, well, that's better. I talked to portfolio managers as opposed to analysts and I'll do that. So I spent 11 and a half years there and then went to Morgan Stanley. The U.S. equity strategy job at Morgan Stanley is really a figureheady job. I ran a Monday morning meeting. The whole firm's dialed in. I had the most read research product at the number one equity business in the world. I travel 32 weeks a year. 2016, I spoke at 44 conferences. Like, you're flying, you're on a plane presenting. Okay. It's big. Yeah. And so it was a lot. You know, at the time, my kids were, I should have been home more. And so I got an opportunity. I thought maybe I should go to the buy side. And so I went and built a close relationship with several buy-siders and I went to work a pretty well-known fund at the time called Eminence Capital. It actually just closed a couple of weeks ago, run by an incredibly good investor named Ricky Sandler. And so my job there was to help the firm get more analytically rigorous around risk management, position sizing, diagnosing trades, look for patterns of behavior, all bottom-up stock pickers. And then the goal was after we put this quantitative infrastructure in place to maybe launch a partially quantitative, partially fundamental fund. And so it was an awesome place, but the firm lost money in 2018 for the first time since inception in 99. So I knew that was going to delay our fundraise. And so I decided to go with the support of the firm, run my own fund. And so that was a little bit of a bump in the road, as you called it, which is that I decided, I did about 300 investor meetings in the second half of 2019. And I decided to launch our fund May 1st, 2020, which really required circling the capital in March, second half of March of 2020. So I didn't know there was going to be this COVID thing or whatever. I think we might have met even at when I was trying to raise money for
my fund
at UBS.
Cap Intro.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. I was on a panel there. So anyway, I launched anyway, but it was kind of an impaired fundraise. And so, you burn a bunch of dough when you're running sub-op, you don't have enough cash. So on a day, February of 21, where my biggest position got taken out at a premium, I decided, it hit me like a lightning bolt, which maybe is the Bernstein paranoia coming full circle on you. I decided, no, this is a good day to return all the capital, right? Like birdie the last hole, everyone gets their money back. Nobody can say I lost any money. The thing that I was really recognizing when I was running the fund was people wanted my quarterly letters. And we had done some creative things in the letters. This will sound wrong when I say it out loud, but it was either July or August of 2020. Zoom was worth more than Morgan Stanley plus Goldman Sachs combined. So I wrote in my letter, like, I won't use the expletives on your thing here, but this is effed up. I wrote, this is effed up. And it just didn't make any sense to me. And we had created a bit of a work from home reopening kind of tag just to make sure, because it just seemed like these work from home stocks were getting too ebullient. And so we ended up having a framework where we were kind of quantitatively tagging stocks so they have exposure to work from home reopening. So when November 9th of 2020 happened, Pfizer's vaccine announcement, we really didn't get hurt by that rotation. And so I started realizing, like, I'm good at risk management. I did it at a big fund. We should probably go start a business. I know a lot of institutional investors have spent my whole career doing that. So 5 years ago now, we launched Trivariate Research. And so that was kind of the origin story of kind of trying to capitalize on that in the background that I had.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Yeah. Talk about your work at Trivariate and data and how central that is to what you're doing, Adam, and the model itself at Trivariate.
Sure. Yeah. So look, every day for the biggest 3,000 US equities, we download or compute hundreds of pieces of information. We've always done it this way. So this isn't about AI. The AI tools can help with efficiency. But when we started the business, even the hedge fund in 2019, it took us about 9 months to build a database. All the researchers we have are very quantitative, and their backgrounds are all quantitative in nature, graduate degrees and things that are quantitative. They're all expert Python programmers. They're all expert at natural language processing and brains called transcripts and that kind of stuff. So we kind of rely on that database. So a lot of what we offer our clients is just, instead of you having to buy hundreds of thousands of dollars of data and spend months setting up the infrastructure and then a couple of full-time employees to help you manage that, just kind of use us for that. Use us for risk management, for idea generation, for framework testing, that kind of stuff. So that's kind of what we do. The Trivariate is an institutional business. We sell to institutions, including UBS Asset Management, obviously is a client of ours, but like the content and bespoke work in advance. We also have a business that we sell capitalizing on that database called Trivector Research, a newsletter. It's 3 or 4 times a week. We sell a newsletter. We do weekly videos. We do monthly Zooms where people can ask questions. We write stuff like we just talked about a little bit, like trying to make 1 month market calls or how to dollar cost average new business. We have a lot of advisors. That Trivector business is $100 a month, $1,200 a year newsletter. You should subscribe. Look at me selling you now on your own damn thing.
Whose podcast is this, Adam?
No, but so people should go to trivectorresearch.com and check it out for if they're individuals or advisors. The institutional business is obviously, it's a 6-figure per year thing. So no normal person walking down the street would sign up for that. It's all data driven, to answer your question. It's all trying to kind of capitalize on that information in a unique way.
What happens, Adam, when the data tells you something, but your gut is telling you something different, or your instincts are telling you something different? Because your clients are paying for the model, but they're also paying for Adam Parker. So
yeah,
how do you handle situations like that?
No, that's the beauty of it. I think for the US, for stock picking, like some things fundamentals are going to be better alone and quant doesn't help. Some things quant will be better and fundamentals don't help. And some things are probably both. I mean, and so I try to think a lot about like, where would I deploy resources? If I run a big asset management arm and I had a bunch of alpha generating widget analysts working for me, like where should I put them to separate from the index? So we call that available alpha. You're right. I mean, the reason the firm is called Trivariate, the three variables are quant, fundamental, and macro. The idea is that sometimes one or all of those things can impact the stock's price or what introduces volatility in the price. And obviously, it's a bit of a capitalizing on my background, too, because I had a PhD in statistics, number one ranked analyst, you know, strategist at Morgan Stanley. So I thought, okay, there was quant, fundamental, macro. So that was kind of the origin name. When you combine it, it kind of makes sense. Some stocks, macro moves them a lot. Some, it doesn't. Biotech company, it doesn't matter, right? You know, quant can really ingest information and explain a lot of returns. Others, you know, there's a complex capital structure. Think about SpaceX you mentioned. Like, what the hell would quant help you there? Like, there's not, you know.
Exactly.
So I think you're right. Like, you want to use your judgment. And then the other thing that's tricky is also, like, the market gets increasingly anticipatory, right? So when I started covering Intel, I remember they raised their capital spending. CNBC said, oh, this is super bullish. That demand's so good, they need to build a new facility. And the stock went up. Then 4 or 5 years later, by 2004 cycle, they raised CapEx, stock went down because people said, well, I saw that movie. The movie was higher depreciation burden on COGS, revenue declines, margins go 60 to 50. So the market might like something this cycle and then hate it by the next cycle, depending on what happens. So I think it's a combination of judgment, gauging how anticipatory investors will be, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So it's both. I agree.
That's great. It's funny you said CNBC because I wanted to ask you a question about CNBC because we see you on CNBC a lot.
Yeah.
And how does that seat sort of change how you communicate, think about work, you know, being more of a media personality now in finance and getting on TV a lot, doing podcasts? And, you know, does that change anything for you in terms of, you know, how you communicate? You know, how does that fit in with Trivariate?
I mean, we've gotten business both for Trivariate and Trivector from doing it. I think it's probably more for Trivector, to be honest with you. It's just more like individuals, advisors watching and sign up for the newsletter. We have gotten some exposure on the Trivariate side, also some big non-US accounts that watch it, and just some big, as you know, there's a lot of large RIAs that are rolled up and they have like institutional-like presences. And so we've gotten clients from it. I was walking down the street with one of my kids and somebody said they knew me from the channel, and then my kid called me a D-list celebrity right to my face. So, and I thought that's probably good.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But no, I don't even think about it, to be honest with you. I like talking to smart people. I think it's interesting to produce content. And so we'll see. I talk to a lot of reporters, you know, Barron's and Bloomberg and other things as well. It just depends. The distribution of knowledge on the reporter side is really wide. There's some that are like really strong. Maybe it's like financial advisors. Some are really good and some don't have basic financial concepts mastered. It's pretty similar on the reporter side.
Yeah. What I've seen the last 2.5 years doing this is really, it's not even like the financial acumen. A lot of the technology and stuff can do that job for us these days. It's really the customer service levels, and it's staying on top of your clients, and it's being responsive. And thankfully for me, having that institutional background where if you didn't respond to a portfolio manager very quickly, it was going to trade away. So you had to get back right away, had to be on top of things, extremely organized. It's been very helpful for us. And we've won a lot of market share because of that. It's been fascinating to actually witness. So Adam, another more personal question. If you think about all the great investors, all the great strategists, all the great people you've been around in the industry, what do you think separates and you in that sense of great decision-making from the average Joe that thinks this is an easy business and they can take care of it?
Well, yeah, I don't know if I'm in that cohort that's great. Probably that's a little grandiose, but I just think people should take a step back, and I'll answer it a different way. A lot of times you get successful doing one thing and then you confuse that with maybe thinking you're going to be good at other things. Like, think about investors who then buy sports teams and then are surprised they're not good at running the sports team. Or you buy a restaurant and you're not good at that, or a Broadway show, or a drug company. Like, the skills that require you to be great at one thing may not translate to another, you know? And yeah. I just feel like a lot of times, maybe poker is a good example, right? Like, I can get my money in good and still lose, right? And I think people sometimes do this thing called superstitious learning where they buy a stock and it goes up. They think it's because they had skill they didn't. I'll give you an amazing example of that. Somebody I know well is a big reader and they really like the Kindle. And so about 15 or 17 years ago, when they stopped bringing books on the airplane and got the Kindle, they thought, this is awesome. And they bought Amazon stock and never sold it since then. And I cannot untether this person from the fact that Kindle has nothing to do with why Amazon's been a good stock. Okay.
It's so good.
Yeah. This person doesn't care about AWS and doesn't care about the fact that their revenue has grown to be as big as Walmart's. They think it's because of Kindle. And so the point is, like, they've 20x their money because of Kindle, right? So it's just an example of superstitious learning. Look, I would phrase it this way. You're competing against some of the smartest people with the most resources and the best computers. And think about some of these multi-strats that are out there, right? The best risk management. So like, yeah, you might be able to, maybe this is a good analogy. Maybe we could go to the free throw line and I could make a free throw and Steph Curry could miss. Maybe, but is Steph Curry better at basketball than me? Yeah. Maybe you can make a 10-foot putt. Scottie Scheffler would miss, but are you a better ball for them? It's the same concept. Like, you're competing against people that are just so much better with so much more resources than you. So I don't know why more people don't realize that it's not something that they can specialize in.
But I agree.
No, it's a human spirit, I guess. I'm very aware when I play golf and I'm an amateur.
One of my clubs that I'm a member at, I actually think I'm very good right now. By next Sunday, I'm sure I'll be particularly humbled. Adam, as we start to think towards the end of the podcast, a couple more questions for me. This is more for my audience. Where can somebody find your work? Where can they go to learn more about what you're doing and how much value you're creating for the community out there?
No, thanks. I mean, obviously we have a LinkedIn and an X, but they should just go to trivectorresearch.com, www.trivectorresearch.com. It's $100 a month newsletter. And I think it's awesome. I mean, we do try to write those thought pieces we talked about. We do ETF analysis, like the Dave Portnoy sort of pizza review style, where we say, this one's good, this one's not, because it's not giving you exposure. You think some ETFs are very misleading. And then we do weekly videos. Like, all I do all day is talk to institutional investors and do meetings and present my content to them. So I get a lot of feedback on it. I try to share like the pulse of what's going on. And then I do a monthly Zoom where people can ask me questions live. So it's just a lot of content they get. We have a weekly dashboard that try to put unique data in. So we'd love people to go and sign up. I probably should raise pricing, but it's $100 a month. So we're trying to get that business out there.
Yeah. I blame it on your two Cracker Jack sales guys.
Both of them work for you. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. They're good men.
You didn't teach them too well, I guess, if they're pricing.
Don't blame that on me.
Exactly.
I always close with the tagline that we came up with is beyond the balance sheet, because our podcasts are more than just, you know, somebody's story or investments. It's about life. It's about other things. And wealth and well-being is so much more than just money. And so when you think about beyond the balance sheet, what does wealth and well-being mean to you?
Wow. I mean, it's such a personal question. For me, I guess it's probably not too contrarian of a view, but, you know, I feel like the most important decision you make in your life is who you marry. And then I'm trying to be a good parent. I'm not sure I am, but I'm trying hard. I mean, I'm trying not to get fatter. I'm just saying about the things I think about, right? Like, I don't want to be a bad husband, a bad father, and obese. So those are beyond wealth creation. Those three are really high up my list.
By the way, if you can deliver on all three of those,
I'm just being honest.
Good.
Just being honest. I don't want to sound shallow where I say, oh, my New Year's resolution is to get richer and skinnier, but that probably should be my New Year's. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm being serious though, like, right? I mean, what are the things we all stress about? One of my very best friends is Swedish, and he told me something I thought about like 20 years ago, which is be the nicest to the people that love you the most. It's a human question you ask me, so I'm giving you the human answer.
That's awesome, you know, and it's not surprising, but it's great. You know, we just had a lovely symposium last week. One track was emerging generations, so 20 to 30-year-olds that are on the up and up. And then the other track was women's wealth and well-being. And we had, you know, 14, 15 great speakers. In fact, Adam, I would love for you to be a presenter at that next year.
Let me know.
Fabulous event. The CEO of the Women's World Bank there. I mean, just fabulous people. And I always ask that question at the end. And it's funny how, it's not funny, but I guess it makes sense. Everybody comes back to sort of the same things. Their wealth creates their ability to do the things that they want to do. It creates freedom. And that freedom allows them to be a better dad, a better mom, a better spouse, take care of their health a little bit more. And I'm not surprised that those are the similar answers to everyone, but they are. And it's something that I certainly aspire to as well. So that's awesome. Well, Adam, listen, we've covered a lot of ground. It's been really great chatting with you. I wish you the best with Trivariad. I think incredibly highly of Ryan and Colin and your colleagues and the work that you do. They're very important people to me and my life and my journey in this. And they speak so highly of what you guys are doing there. So it's been a really great pleasure getting to know you a little bit better, other than just on a panel, you know, a decade ago. Appreciate the time, Adam. And for the audience, as we like to close, Michael Pasquale, michael.pasquale, P-A-S-Q-U-A-L-E at ubs.com. Please continue to send in your feedback on these podcasts. Really great to have Adam with us today. To the audience, as we always close out, keep looking beyond the balance sheet. Have a wonderful day. And thank you again, Adam. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm your host, Michael Pasquale. At Beyond the Balance Sheet, we explore the stories, strategies, and insights shaping the future of wealth, well-being, and legacy. To keep up with our latest conversations, please subscribe to our podcast and share it with a friend who might enjoy these discussions. If you have any questions, feedback, or topics you'd like us to cover, please reach out to me at michael.pasquale@ubs.com. Until next time, keep looking beyond the balance sheet.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.